The Accidental Creative starts now.
Well, hello everyone, welcome to our first ever Accidental Creative live event. It's great to be with you, and I hope everybody can hear me okay. If you can't hear me, in your software on the right hand side there, you should have some capacity to be able to raise your hand and or be able to offer indication that you can't do that. We also have on the right hand side some polls and chats we're going to be doing throughout the course of the presentation tonight, so we can kind of gauge what's going on in your community and what's going on in your on your team and within the context of your own creating and collaborating. Hopefully you can hear me. We're going to be also tonight doing a few slides to kind of help us get going. So why don't we do that right now? So welcome. We're really excited to have you guys with us tonight. This is the first in what I'm hoping is many, many to come Accidental Creative live events. We're going to be bringing some of the best minds and topics to the table and having some discussion around them as a community. I'm also excited. This is the beginning of our Creative Leader Roundtable sessions. And we have several distinguished panelists with us tonight who are going to be helping walk us through this as well. So I would like to introduce them right now. We have with us tonight Richard Westendorf, who is with us from Landor Associates. And let me actually unmute Richard really quick so he can say hey to everyone. Richard, are you with us?
I am.
All right, fantastic. Well, hey, you want to tell anybody a little bit about what you do?
I'm the executive creative director of our Cincinnati office. Landor has 24 offices around the world, and I lead the creative group, so packaging, corporate identity, brand environments, and digital environments as well.
Fantastic. Well, hey, Richard, thanks so much for being with us tonight. We're going to be getting back to you guys in a little bit. We also have with us tonight Ricardo Crespo. Ricardo, welcome, and thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, great to be here, Scott.
It's okay. Scott, Todd, whatever. You can call me whatever. Ricardo, you want to tell everybody a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I work as a group creative director at Mattel in El Segundo, California, and oversee a lot of the branding development and sort of major branding activities for a big group in a lot of our portfolio. Basically, anything that's not Barbie falls in my camp. And I have a good fortune, great teams to work with that helps me get through the daily output, if you will.
Fantastic. You should have, that should be on your business card, actually, creative director, everything except Barbie. That would be great. Fantastic. And we also have with, thank you so much, Ricardo, for being with us tonight. We also have with us Scott Hall from Scott Hall Associates. Scott, say hello, please.
Greetings, fans.
And the masses go wild. Scott, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do?
I've been fortunate enough for the last 28 years to run a company, Scott Hall Associates, which is focused on, we're basically an art agency that's recognized for assisting businesses to relate to their customers through non-traditional ways of utilizing art and graphics and such.
Fantastic. So you have obviously worked with a lot of artists and worked at the intersection of, I guess what we could say is art and commerce, which is a lot of what we're going to talk about tonight. So Scott, thanks so much for being with us. We really appreciate you being here.
I'm honored.
All right. And can you guys, by the way, Scott, are you able to see my screen right now? Are you able to see the presentation?
Here I am.
Okay. All right. Good. Just want to make sure. If at any point you can't, please let me know. Okay. We've had some glitches going on here with the deal. So anyway, so it's great to have our panel with us tonight. Well, tonight we're going to be talking about relationships specifically within the context of creative teams. Now, it could be tempting for us to consider this soft stuff, perhaps, or nice, but unnecessary when there's real work to be done. And I know that I've fallen prey to that as well. When we get in the trenches, when things are hot and things are happening, it can be tough sometimes to take the time that we need to have to take in order to be able to have conversations with people and actually gauge processes. We've talked before about on the Accidental Creative podcast specifically, the end product is the final sort of tip of the iceberg, if you will, to the entire process that goes into creating something. And that is actually where the majority of our time as artists is spent within organizations, is in the context of process. And so when we neglect process, we can create room for all kinds of things to creep in to the dynamics of our team and ultimately affect our creating. So I hope tonight to show that there's a very real and tangible benefit to engaging in the right conversations at the right times on our teams. Fostering a team that values process will lead to better product in the end because it will grow your team, it will create an environment of trust, and ultimately it'll help you get the best work out of the artist. And we all have a bottom line, right? And so we all want to get the best work out of the artist on our team. I know we have in this conversation a lot of people who are leaders within organizations based upon the data that you've given us when you signed up for the webinar. Also, a lot of people on this session who are artists within the context of teams. And maybe some of you are saying, why am I here? Because I don't necessarily either lead people. I'm not really being led by people. Maybe you're a freelancer. Maybe you're sort of floating around the periphery of the create on demand world, but leadership is everyone's business. And so hopefully tonight, as you think about these conversations, as we discuss these five conversations, you will find something that you can apply to your own life and creating as well. All of this is mostly due to a tension that we often discuss in the AC world between process and product. As we discussed, because organizations are about a bottom line, and they should be, there's a tendency to drive toward highly concrete, highly predictable outcomes, right? In other words, over time, our organizations become product obsessed. And in reality, we must protect the product because it's the link to our clients and our consumer. But what we fail to realize as organizations is that the end product, the thing that I can hold up and look at and sell, is only the tail of a very, very long process. And so while many organizations get it right on the product side, they tank their teams in the process. Turnover is high, trust is low, and there is stress throughout the organization. This ultimately leads to a cultural deterioration and ultimately to an inferior product. Now, I have been guilty of leading teams into what I would call a death spiral, which is where a lot of these learnings come from. And I've also been involved in helping lead teams in a healthy creative process. I've learned a ton from both sides of the equation, being the manager and the boss that nobody wants to look in the eye, and also being the one that has been able to instill some degree of trust in the people around me. So hopefully, as we engage in these conversations tonight, you can hear the depth of pain from which many of them come, okay? If we can learn to value process as well as product, then we can get the best of both worlds. We can have an engaged, trusting, transparent team that's excited about what we're doing and also yield a great product in the end. Now, I know many of you are probably like me, and your cynical side says, yeah, this sounds great in theory, but in the end, if I do this, no one else will, and I'll just end up eating the poisonous mushroom just to prove it's inedible, right? Nobody wants to be the person eating the mushroom saying, I wonder if this is edible, and then they end up being a martyr. Nobody wants to be a martyr, but if I might be so bold, let me say, this is what leadership is all about. It's about doing the hard things regardless of positional authority, right? Regardless of whether you're the official organizational leader or not, doing the right things to attempt to influence and affect change in the world. And that begins by affecting change in the environment around you. If you're breathing, you have a leadership mandate. And that mandate is to engage according to the proper ethic, even if no one else does, okay? Sure, you might be the martyr, true, but you might also just change the world. And ultimately, the way that we change the world is by changing the world around us, okay? Now, what happens when we value product over process is that it allows space, if you will, little cracks for what I call the assassins of the creative process to invade our teams. Okay, I call them assassins because they are stealthy. They're like ninjas, okay? They're very sneaky. And they invade our creative process and they start sniping away at our creative health, at our trust, and the ability to collaborate. And eventually, they even destroy our individual passion and engagement. I don't know about you, but I, on many occasions, have felt or have found that because of the way things are going in my create on demand role, my personal creative passion, the thing that I really love to do, has suffered significantly. As a leader, one of the most important things you can do is keep a watch out for these assassins to protect your team, right? To protect the gate, to keep the assassins out. Learn to identify them and neutralize them immediately. And that's what the conversations will do. Okay, so we're quickly going to talk about the three assassins because these are touch points for what can happen when the teams get off the rails or when we personally get off the rails. And again, this applies to our personal life as well as our team life. Quickly, the first of the three assassins is what we call dissonance. Okay, dissonance is, for example, in music, dissonance is when you hear that chord within a horror film that you know, it's something like dun, 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 right? And it doesn't resolve. There's no resolution. It's when the why and the what don't add up. And your mind wants that resolution. Your mind wants everything to line up and perfectly match up with what you expect. And when you don't, when something happens that you don't expect, it creates a dissonance. It's the phenomenon actually that occurs when we lose all sense of cause and effect within the process. If we say we're about X, but all of our systems are set up to accomplish Y, then our teams will eventually lose hope and they'll assume a victim posture. You know, it's all about alignment and making sure that what we say we're about is what we're actually doing. We need to avoid black boxes where all the decisions about Y are made without any transparency or connection to our systems and processes, right? Now, why is this important? Well, it's important that we learn to identify dissonance because our minds are wired to solve patterns. That's what they do. That's what they're built to do. The creative process is the resolution of dissonance. It's the forging of new patterns from disparate and disconnected stimulus. That's where all great creative ideas come from forming patterns out of things that seem like they don't go together. But our minds don't always understand the difference between a good problem and a bad problem, right? So when there is dissonance within our organizations, the people on our team's minds set about trying to resolve that dissonance and it drives them crazy. I don't know if you've ever been in a team where, you know, there was some lofty vision statement or some lofty ideal that was being held up, but everything in the organization was set up exactly diametrically opposed to what was said. And it drives you crazy because you can't, eventually you just give up because you can't bring alignment between what you're doing on a day-to-day basis and what the organization says it's trying to accomplish. You know, artists are especially adept at forming patterns and making meanings. And when we're misaligned, guess what we're doing? We're trying, even if it's subconsciously, to solve that problem, right? It's wasted mental cycles. We need to be focused on the problem at hand. We need the artists on our teams focused on the problems at hand. So it's not only bad for morale, it causes the product to suffer when we have dissonance within the organization. We need to make sure the why and the what add up. We need to make sure we have alignment between our creative strategy and our executions. And we're going to talk about that as we continue to talk about these conversations tonight. Okay? So that's dissonance, the first of the three assassins of creativity. The second one is fear. Now, this seems kind of maybe a little bit intuitive and maybe like an obvious thing, you know, fear, okay, yeah, I understand that. But there are two types of fear. The most obvious type of fear is fear of failure, which is what happens if this doesn't work? Am I secure? Will I get fired, right? Maybe I shouldn't take a risk because we just had a baby after all, right? That's one kind of fear, which is the fear of failure. And that's probably the most obvious. It's the one we always think of. It's the result of a lack of trust, or it can stem from cultural dissonance, or it can stem from being hired or placed in a position I shouldn't have been placed in to begin with, right? And sometimes we have the wrong people in the wrong places. We don't understand our standing and what's okay versus what's not okay. I always think about, when I think about fear, I think about Neil Fiore and The Now Habit. He had this phenomenal book called The Now Habit, where he, in one place in the book, he discusses this scenario where he would ask some of his clients, he would say, okay, if you had a, let's say a 10-foot plank that was 6 inches wide and I laid it on the ground, would you be able to walk across that plank without falling off? And almost everyone unanimously said, of course, I could walk across that plank, no problem, right? And he said, okay, now let's assume that I elevate that plank. And now instead of being on the ground, it's 100 feet in the air suspended between two buildings. Same plank, same skill set required to cross the plank. Now, do you think you could cross the plank? And of course, people hem and haw and they say, no, I don't think I could, right? Well, what has changed between those scenarios? The skills are the same, right? Nothing is different in terms of skill set to walk across a plank. What's changed is the perceived consequences of failure. And sometimes I think within our teams, we do the same thing. We elevate the consequences of failure in our mind. We raise them to unhealthy levels. So when we have some conversations about consequence, or we're able to talk about what people on our team are afraid of, we can start to neutralize some of these fear issues within our organization. Okay. So again, that will be a part of what we talk about as we introduce these five conversations. The second type of fear, however, is not so obvious, and that is fear of success. What happens if we actually succeed? Right? Can we sustain the pace? What's it going to mean to our team? Do we really want success? Because it's easier just to coast along, right? And we don't know what's just over the horizon because the organization is so unpredictable. And we don't know if we really want to spend ourselves on this, because if we succeed at it, that's going to become our new expectation. And this is the kind of fear that causes our teams to hold back because they don't trust that success will really be all that worth it, or they're not really unified behind what we're trying to do. So it kills our end product. So that's fear. That's the second assassin. So we have dissonance, we have fear, right? And then the third one is expectations. Now, these can be expectations of ourselves, or why can't I seem to measure up like I once did? Maybe we compare something we did once upon a time. They can be expectations of our manager, especially if they're unclear. You know, how is this really supposed to be, and how much time should I spend on it? If I hear one thing, but I sense another thing in our conversations, you know, it can be confusing. So these can also be expectations generated by the examples that we as leaders hold up for our teams. If we're constantly pointing to the cover of CA or ID or holding something up and saying, this is what we should be doing, sometimes that's inspirational, but sometimes without any explanation of process or what we like about it, if we don't point out what we like about it, it can create expectation escalation, and it can destroy the team's process in spirit, right? Because they're constantly trying to measure up to some ideal, and they don't even understand what the ideal means. So those are the three assassins, if you will, of the creative process on teams. And these apply to our personal creating as well. So I challenge you to dive into this for yourself and see if any of these have taken root. If dissonance, if fear, or expectation escalation has taken root in your personal creating, because it can take root in your personal creating as well as in our teams if we don't have alignment and if we're not having conversations to try to dispel these. Okay, so most of what we talk about as we dive into these five conversations is process-focused stuff. It's all about how to have the conversations that countermand and dismantle the assassins, dissonance, fear, and expectations. They're going to help give us a leg up on process within our teams, right? We want to dismantle or countermand these assassins. And I'm sure probably as I'm giving these examples of dissonance, fear, expectations, I know I personally can think of several examples of how I've encountered this in the last week, right? And I'm sure you can as well. And so we need to be equipped to be able to deal with it. Okay, so here are the five conversations. First, a few ground rules. Do not steamroll your team with these, okay? That is the fast track to death on your team if you just walk up and start having deep, meaningful conversations and you've never really done that before. And it's not even going to be like that. It's not going to be some formal thing where you just introduce these conversations. You need to find ways of introducing these into a natural context, right? Whether it's a team meeting, if it's one-on-ones that you have with people, whatever, you need to find ways of asking these, not like looking at your crib notes and reading a question verbatim. That's not what it's about. It's about relationship, trust, and credibility as a leader. Jim Kuzis and Barry Posner in their book, The Leadership Challenge, said that credibility is one of the most critical factors for any leader. We have to have credibility. And in order to have credibility, we have to have relationship and we have to have the trust of our team. Okay, even if it's a virtual relationship, even if we're not one-on-one with people, because a lot of people, when they get to a certain place in the organization, you can't have one-on-ones, but they should at least be getting the trickle down from your relationship with the people that you directly interact with. Okay, so that's the first thing. Do not steamroll your team, whatever you do. Okay, and one more quick ground rule. Okay, you need to be having these conversations both with individuals on the team and on a team level. Okay, you need to be having these conversations on a team level as well as an individual level, because what happens when you only address people individually is, a lot of the you end up with a misaligned team, because you get into a different place of growth with different members on your team. The team needs to grow together as a team, and there are certain things we can't talk about in the context of team, and there are certain things that organizations frown upon us talking about, and I understand that, and especially individually, we don't want to have certain conversations, but it's important that we be able to have these conversations specifically in the context of teams and also individually. And you need to formalize the conversations. In the words of management guru Peter Drucker, what gets measured gets done, right? If you don't have a way, a system and a way for these conversations to take place, then it's not going to happen. You can't wait for an opportune time to occur. It never will. Okay, so the five conversations, drum roll, please. And I'm going to take a drink of water. Sorry. Okay, that was very refreshing. All right, so the five conversations. The first conversation we're going to talk about tonight, and again, some of these may sound very intuitive. It's not what we know, it's what we do, right? Great leaders are the people who do the things that nobody else wants to do. And these are very simple, but very difficult. All right, the first conversation is the clarity conversation. And if you're on this webinar right now, I'm going to be following up with each of you and sending you a PDF that has all of these conversations and some sample questions listed out for you. So you don't necessarily need to write these down, but you can if you want to. I will be following up with this as well as an audio version of this presentation. So the clarity conversation, this conversation is all about bringing alignment and combating dissonance within our teams. It's about making sure that what we say we're about is actually what we're about, right? It's about making sure that we understand the objectives of our projects, our teams, and our organization's reason for being. So a few ways that we can engage in the conversation, the clarity conversation specifically. All right, here's an example of a question. We can actually say, do the why and the what add up? In other words, is what we say we're about what we're actually doing? Is there any lack of clarity around this? One way to ask this question is there anything we're doing right now that seems out of character for us, right? And step back and allow the conversation to ensue. Don't get defensive and don't feel the need to argue. This is not about being right. It's about being discerning, and it's about identifying problems within the team, right? So asking that question, hey, is there anything we're doing right now that seems out of character for us, is a way to understand if there's dissonance, if there's some way that the organization is misaligned, or if there's some way that people are sort of holding on to something that could very easily be dispelled with a simple answer, right? Another approach that we can take to this is, do you understand the objectives? Are they clear? Is there anything that you're unclear about, right? Sometimes people won't speak up because they assume that everyone else gets it, and they're the only idiot in the group, right? And I've been there before myself. This kind of isolation is a lie, and it countermands creative effectiveness. The more we discuss the objectives until everyone is crystal clear, the better off we'll be, okay? Clarity is critical to healthy team creating. We have to understand what we're trying to do before we can do it, and the more clear we can be about what we're trying to do, then the more effective we're going to be as a team, and the more effectively we'll be able to collaborate. The more clear we are about the problems we're trying to solve, the more effective we'll be in that creating. But the less clear we are about aligning the why and the what, the more our process will dissolve into chaos. So the clarity conversation is all about coming against dissonance, right? Dissonance, which is the first of the creative assassins. All right, so that's the clarity conversation. That's the first one. The second one is the expectations conversation. Now, this very simple conversation is designed to neutralize the victim mindset, and it's going to come against fear, and it's also going to come against expectations and some of the ways expectations can become escalated within our organizations. By calling out and allowing conversations about expectations, we can be certain that we're not allowing confusion to grow, which can lead to finger-pointing and self-protection rather than generosity and trust, right? So one simple question that you can ask in the context of a team and definitely in the context of an individual conversation is, do you know what's expected of you, right? I have very rarely had this question asked to me at any given point in my organizational career, right? Get the artist to express their understanding of expectations directly and simply. It's important that they express what they think their expectations are rather than you telling them what their expectations are. And another way that you can ask is, what do you expect from me, right? And sometimes you can even ask, am I falling short, which is a little bit scarier. But again, don't be defensive and try to defend yourself. If the stated expectations are unrealistic, then have that conversation. But it's important that you realize that your role as a leader is to serve, not to be right, right? I know that we all have to protect certain things, but at the same time, great leaders are there to serve their team and to clear obstacles out of the way of their team, right? Not to be right. So that's the expectations conversation. Again, we're going to be having some more interaction around these in just a little bit. All right, the third conversation is the fear conversation. Now, this is the most nebulous of the conversations, and it's one of the more difficult to get people to open up to, but it can be one of the most powerful conversations if we actually have the guts to engage in it. This is all about shining light into dark, unspoken places and neutralizing any emerging fear that might be taking root in the organization. So one simple question that we can ask is, what are you afraid might happen and why in the context of our conversations, right? In other words, what makes you gun shy in your creating? Is there anything right now that's making you gun shy in your creating? Do you feel free to take risks, right? And if not, why? And what environmental cues are leading you to that result? You know, do you feel free to take creative risks? And if the answer is no, why is it that you don't feel free to take risks? Because I feel like personally, we're cultivating a culture that encourages you to take risks, but you seem to not think that's the case. So I'd like to have that conversation with you. Okay, so that's the fear conversation. Again, this is coming directly against fear, which is one of the creative assassins and a source of pain and confusion and anger within creative organizations. Okay, then we have the engagement conversation, number four. This conversation is all about identifying patterns of engagement, energy, and enthusiasm on the team. Creativity is rhythmic, both on an individual and team level, and we have to take that into account as we're planning our work, right? The conversation helps you, the engagement conversation helps you as the leader of process to gauge where the team is in terms of energy and engagement and to plan accordingly. It also helps the team in a collective sense to gain a better understanding of where each member is in terms of inspiration and energy level. Right. So as a team, collectively, this is a good conversation to have. You know, what's the energy level and enthusiasm for the work that we're doing right now? You know, what do you guys think about it? Right. What's inspiring you? It's always helpful for me to hear what other people are being inspired by and what's engaging them creatively. A lot of our best ideas are not going to come from staring at something we've already done or staring at something somebody else is doing. It's going to come from outside of the normal realm of our day-to-day experience. And you never know when somebody's going to introduce some bit of stimulus that's going to inspire your team to create something that it would never have done had this conversation not taken place, right? Okay, and another question is, how do you feel about the work we're doing right now, right? Now, these aren't everyday conversations, and hopefully we have the discernment to understand that these aren't everyday conversations. And this isn't some formal system where if I check off all these conversations, then we're going to be in good shape. No, because you have to bring yourself to this, right, as a leader. So it's not enough to simply check off these questions. This all happens in the context of our normal leadership and our normal conversations. All right. And then a really great question is this: what's the best thing we're doing and why? I love to ask that question because it's always something different. It seems like it's always a different answer from different people. And it's always reasoning that I quite frankly, I never even thought of. But again, it helps me to see where things might be confusing or where we might not have thought, hey, there's something here that we need to be thinking about. And, you know, man, the people in the trenches, the artists on our team, they get it. They understand it, right? Because they're in the grind. So it's important to have the conversation about engagement. And then finally, it's appropriate, the final 10% conversation, or in this case, I guess the final 20% because it's the last of five conversations. But anyway, the final 10% conversation, right? This conversation is all about neutralizing, as my friend Ben, who's a creative director at a video production house, he likes to call them whispers in the hallway. These are the conversations that emerge when a small group of people want to commiserate, but they don't have the guts to speak their thoughts to the organization, either because they're spineless, which happens a lot, or because there isn't a culture of trust, right? And they're afraid. But either way, you are way better off having these conversations in a team context and one-on-one than allowing them to fester and create dissonance and fear. So what you're going to do in this conversation is ask them to tell you the final remnant. In other words, what's the final 10%? You're telling me about 90%, but what's the final little 10% that you don't really have the guts to tell me, but you probably don't want to use those words, right? But what's the final remnant of feedback that they're not going to volunteer unless you ask for it? So if you have the courage, this is a really poignant question to ask. what's the dumbest thing that I or we are doing, right? Organizationally or creatively? Like, what do you think is the dumbest thing that we're doing? This is probably a conversation you want to have in private, not a conversation you want to have in the context of team, right? Before you, you know, bring the smack down on someone or whatever. But it's an important question, right? Because we don't know what we don't know. So it's important that we are have the courage to be able to ask, hey, where am I being an idiot? Because I want to lead. I don't know about you. I want to lead and I want to be effective in my leadership. I don't want to just have the illusion of effectiveness. I want to be effective. So what's the dumbest thing I'm doing right now? Followed up by, hey, what's the smartest thing that I or we are doing right now? What do you think is the smartest thing we're doing right now? Right? Because again, we don't know what we don't know. And so it's really good to know what is the organizational gauge. Now, they might be wrong because they don't have all the information, but it doesn't matter. What matters is that you understand their experience and you understand their perception of what's going on, right? And you're also going to get a new perspective on things. And then another very important or poignant question you can ask is, what's something obvious that you don't think I see, right? And this is an important question as well. What's something obvious that you don't think I see? Because a lot of times we don't see things as the leader that the people who are actually in the trenches, you know, are seeing. They're understanding some dynamics maybe that we're not seeing, or they're experiencing things that we're not experiencing because, you know, we have our mind on other things. We're always looking forward. Maybe we've crossed four or five bridges they haven't crossed yet. So what's something obvious that's going on that you don't think I see can be a very, very important and very helpful question to ask because it helps us to see things through the lens of the people on our team, okay? So those are the five conversations, right? And we're going to have more conversation about the five conversations, but the clarity conversation, right? The expectations conversation, the fear conversation, the engagement conversation, and the final 10% conversation. These conversations need to be happening in some way, shape, or form and in some format within your team in order to neutralize those three assassins we talked about, right? Dissonance, fear, and expectations. Creating is tough. It is very difficult. And leading the creative process is nearly impossible because you have all of these disparate people who are brought together very loosely around projects who would in no other way, shape, or form end up in the same room together, right? But you have to somehow pull people together and foster collaboration and lead them toward a common objective. And having these conversations, right, gets at the psychology or the stuff that's underneath the hood of the creative process and helps us engage in a healthier process and helps us as leaders build the trust and credibility we need to be able to make hard calls and to be able to push people when we have to push people. If we're having conversations and people really believe that we trust them and that we actually are interested and we're not just trying to squeeze the creative juices out of them, then they're going to be more likely to step up to the plate when we ask them to do it, first of all. But more than that, the bottom line and the end product is going to be better if we have an engaged, trusting, motivated, and relationally connected team. All right? So we're going to open it up to our panel, and I have some conversations for our panel, for Richard, Ricardo, and Scott. So I'm going to quit out here, and let's bring our panel up. Hopefully everybody is still with us. All of our panelists still with us. Are we still there, guys?
Yes.
Fantastic. Okay. Fantastic.
Yes.
All right. Also on the right-hand side, you guys can see, I think we got everybody up now. On the right-hand side, you guys can see there's room to chat, I believe, for all of you. And also, if anybody has a question, you can start asking a question on the right-hand side. If you guys want to ask a question, then you guys can do that on the right-hand side of the screen, okay? And I'm also going to push out a poll here because I'd like to hear what you guys think about this. Which of these conversations do you need the most work on as a team? So if you guys want to answer that question, you can do that as well. Okay, you can answer that question. But why don't we start with our panelists? And guys, you all have had obviously long and varied careers in, you know, creative spheres. And I'm curious, and Ricardo, why don't we start with you? What is the most challenging thing about collaborating within your organization or within the organizational experience you've had? What is the most challenging thing?
Well, in the current situation, I think it's really, Todd, the idea that collaboration is such a huge word, but it's the idea of aligning everybody through the same expectations as far as timing. When do you need to get stuff done and things like that? And how do we align the milestones of those timing, of that timing that we do as designers, as creatives, to those things that we need to do for our marketing counterparts within our organization, our teams? But that sense, that's really the biggest juggernaut that always seems to happen regularly. And what we're trying to do and what we're successfully doing each time is we're getting ahead of it by having the conversations way early on in the process. A perfect example I'll illustrate is from the nature of what we do in our business, that we'll have our product guys sketching out things, items, toys, if you will, that they might be creating 2 years out from now. And, you know, up until recently, it was like, okay, let's get the packaging and the branding guys in. Oh, geez, we forgot we got to package this thing. So what we found now is getting the conversation up early on to be able to work with them. And it segues into everything you talked about here, Todd, is that it sets up those conversations about clarity, about expectations, when, milestones, and things like that. And it helps reduce the fear, ultimately, at the end of the day, when you know what's coming up, so you can prepare for it. But I think it's just aligning a mass number of disciplines under one strategic direction.
And do you have what would be, I mean, you mentioned getting engaged in conversation early in the process. Is there anything other else specifically that you think has really helped you to do that?
Well, it's the idea that we actually, you know, for up until recently as well, that the creative brief was really written by the marketing teams, if you will. Mm-hmm. And what we've been doing dramatically different is we're up front and we're actually pre-populating the creative brief on their behalf and then saying, is there anything here that you don't agree with? And what that does is it's so empowering because it shows our partners within the company that even though the perception prior was we were the back end in the development process, we move ourselves up by our own actions to say, we know what's going to happen historically, and this is what we think is going to happen, and you guys agree so that we can get ahead of it. So that's one of the activities that we're starting to do regularly now.
Great. Well, Richard, I would be curious how you would answer this question, because you're obviously working at one office, but you also have responsibilities around the globe, really, in many ways. I'd be curious to hear, what is the most challenging thing for you about collaborating within your organization?
I think, Ricardo, you know, as I was listening to how he relates within his organization, there's some parallels. You know, he's talking about marketing counterparts, and you know, our partners within would be client service or, you know, the strategists. And when Ricardo was talking about, you know, getting involved kind of further up front in the process, that's something that I think parallels with what we do, in that, you know, we're always working from a creative brief, but if it lands on your desk and you don't agree with, you know, a third of it, that's a problem. And I think what we've also tried to strive to do as an organization is look at those client service or strategist partners as truly partners and not let them off the hook, even when we're doing creative. We're going through a whole kind of renaissance process within our organization. And to your point of, you know, what are we doing globally, that's starting to influence other offices, in that the CEO of our organization saw what we were doing, and now he's asked other offices around the world, what are you guys going to do for a renaissance program? And part of that is the idea that, you know, creative ideas don't reside solely within the design group, that we can't allow, you know, strategists to come and just, you know, kind of tap their foot with deadlines or worry about scopes and budget. Solving design problems, and we feel like they have something to add.
Well, Scott, you've sort of come at things from a different perspective, given your role, and you're obviously working with artists, and you're actually working trying to sell into organizations, which is interesting. But I would be curious, what has been the difficult thing for you in collaborating between the organizations you work with and the artists that you work with?
Well, I think presently with this change that we're having, which, you know, as we talk about, is the age of creative economics. And I'm finding it very fascinating, and I've been doing probably way too much research on what is the change, the dynamics, and how is the creative community being involved in the business sector. Ricardo and Richard, I thought, wow, you guys are hitting the nail right on the head. Because one thing I've realized in researching and studying patterns is the fact that, you know, I would say by 05, corporations were under that command control in which, like you talked about, Richard, you have that center of energy and he's telling you what is expected and what needs to be done. And then we started moving into shortly for consultations and boards. But now what I'm seeing in terms of collaboration is more of a wide range where we're needing, in order to move faster, and especially with this social technology that we have now, it is so important to get everybody engaged on the same page. But one thing that we have realized in working with, you know, the creative artist and then also with our customer is a fact of making sure that everybody understands what the goal of the project is. And so this, I'll call it enterprise or collaboration, is very, very important for today. And I think also for the future, we're seeing it.
Well, we did a little poll in our community here and, looks like it's pretty evenly distributed except for the engagement conversation. By the way, I am getting some cues that, people are not hearing, my microphone. Are you guys hearing me okay?
It's stuttering quite a bit on my side.
It's Scott. Stuttering
I
quite a
I
bit.
I can hear you, but it's stuttering.
It's stuttering here too.
Okay. All right. Is it stuttering? All right. I'm sorry about that, guys. I apologize. I'll see what I can do about that. See if I can fix that. But
hey, Tom, do you have a cell phone nearby?
Yeah,
I mean,
actually,
that's what it is.
Oh, you know what? Actually, I do. Is that what you're hearing? Is like cell phone interference, perhaps?
No. I'm wondering if that's creating the stuttering. Just
oh,
to
okay.
You.
Oh, it's very possible. Actually, it's an iPhone. That's probably what it is. I am recording this. So if you're having a difficult time hearing, I'm actually recording it in a different way than what you're hearing on the line right now. So this will be available for you. If you're listening to this, you're going to be able to get this, not what you're hearing necessarily on the line, but you'll be able to get this in a much better sounding format. So I'll make that available to you as well. So hopefully that will, that will take care of any issues that you have. So thank you guys for... yes, I am wearing a headphone, a headset. No, and that wasn't a product placement iPhone mention. Thanks, Sean, who asked the question. But anyway, so as we're seeing here across the sphere here, we're seeing that it's pretty evenly distributed between clarity, expectations, fear, and final 10%. But clarity and expectations conversations seem to be the most difficult, the ones that teams need the most work on. I'm curious for you guys, which one of these five conversations we mentioned do you feel like you do the best, and which one do you feel like you do the worst? And Richard, why don't we start with you?
I think clarity, I think we're doing a pretty good job of it. When we're doing performance reviews or talking, when individual teams are having individual conversations, everybody's pretty clear on, why are we here and what are we doing?
Hmm.
I think the final 10% is probably one that we're not doing as well at.
Hmm. Okay, how about you, Ricardo?
I would agree with what Richard is saying, but expectations is something that we are trying to get way ahead of. As I mentioned earlier, clarity is something that we've taken a good hold on, in that we're sort of populating the briefs early on and then just having marketing and our other partners confirm those things. But expectations is something that we've really started doing, I think, well in our organization. And if I could add one of the exercises that we've done that's worked out well is, once a project hits our team, the first thing I'll do is I'll assemble the team and we'll literally hand out these blank sheets of paper. And at first they were looking around the table looking at me like, well, what do you want me to do with this? But it was an interesting exercise that as it started to get some traction, as we had a couple of these practices under our belt over a couple of projects, it really started to just gain that consistency. And really all I had the individual people in their respective disciplines. So I had my art director, my writer, a product engineer, a package engineer, things like that. I actually had them go out under the same premise of what the project was, but had them all populate their own work back schedule. And what that basically said was, if we know that we have to deliver X by this date, and this is our conversation today, what are the big milestones that you need to have happen that you're going to lead from your point of view? And then what happens is, after about a week, we all come back and everyone sort of shares their milestones, and we find very cleverly where those things come to connect, and we sort of target one big milestone where we all will come back. But what we're finding is, when we do this more often than not, the consistency of milestones come up to the surface all the time. And what it does is it lessens the fear. So what you talked about, Todd, it provides the clarity. Plus, it gives us a chance to manage that holy grail that we all know as creatives is, you know, always creating on demand is, you know, we don't have that design button, have it ready by tomorrow. Mm-hmm. By having those milestones pre-written ahead, we know how to attack the problems that we see are going to come up. Mm-hmm. And so having each of the team members, respective to their disciplines, populate their own work back, what I call a work back milestone calendar, brings us all back to one central place and aligns to our strategy. But it gives them clear objectives in short increments of time to be able to feel like they're chipping away at the bigger project without having to leave things to the last minute, which is human nature, procrastination. But we try to avoid that by having these tools in place.
It's interesting you say that, because I had a conversation this week with someone who was having difficulty within their organization getting the artists on the team to buy into the milestones, which the artists themselves had set, which is an interesting thing. And you know, my response was, and when are you going to go look for new artists on your team? I was kind of halfway joking, but you know, to some extent, like the artists, obviously, I mean, I think what's really great about your response is that you're getting buy-in early in the process, right, from the artists on your team. And that, you know, to that point, that is a form of, you know, building credibility and relational capital within the team by helping them, you know, maintain ownership of those milestones.
Right. And inadvertently, they exercise that leadership trait, because they are then speaking to their other partners outside of their own discipline to saying, hey, this is what I need to do to have this happen. I'm going to have this ready for you. Will you be ready for it? Mm. And it really has everybody on their guard, which is great. Mm. You know, it has everyone prepared, you know.
Great. Well, I want to get to some of the questions, because I do have some questions from the crew that's listening into us here. And if you have a question, you can over on the right hand side of your screen, if you're on your computer, you should be able to ask a question. But before we do that, I would like to ask, because I know we have some people on the call right now who are not necessarily, wouldn't be considered classically like organizational mantle leadership type roles within their organizations, but I know that they're here because they're concerned about obviously the dynamic within their organization, or they want to understand and be equipped to be a leader within their context. So what is your advice for a creative on a team that's trying to make a difference in their environment, specifically if it's not, maybe not the most relational environment, or it's not an environment where process is valued? What would be your advice to that artist on that team? Scott, why don't we start with you?
Okay. Well, I think Richard and Ricardo hit some very good points regarding this early on. One thing that we're doing is basically what you're talking about, is that expectation factor. Because I'm working with independent artists who are basically working virtual, and we're dealing with sometimes advertising agencies, sometimes design groups, sometimes in-house corporate. So to get them to grow and to really look at what they're trying to achieve in the project, I basically ask them five questions, or we try to review five questions. What are your goals and your priority issues for success? What should you be measuring? And I think that's a real key one, as Ricardo pointed out, is that measuring factor, that milestones. And have you defined acceptable levels of success? We get hung up too much on trying to overthink things. I'm certainly guilty of that. And then measuring consistently and being consistent. That's the big thing, I think, with an artist's career that they need to look at, is try to build a pattern of being consistent, of being prolific. And then what tools and techniques work for you? That's something else that we try to have discussions frequently amongst our groups. And Richard and Ricardo, I'm sure you guys do the same as well. So we learn from each other. Hmm. So those are some of the tricks that we use.
Great. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Richard, how would you advise a creative who's trying to make a difference on their team?
Well, I think one way to approach it is, I'm not certain that team members always feel like they have a voice, or that they can speak out, or, you know, if they're having, you know, difficulty with a particular project or brand. We instituted something that, you know, we would literally call a brand intervention, where we as senior leaders on the you know, the teams feel like if someone comes to us too late, it's too late. And the feeling with, you know, that we get when we finally do talk to people is that, you know, we're empowered to be strong leaders, no matter who we are in the chain, you know, the thinkers, the problem solvers. And if we raise a red flag, we think we failed. And, you know, we're trying to stress to people that, you know, we are all in this together. And, you know, if you bring up the problem, you know, with people that may have experienced it before or have a different perspective, it's like, we're open to hearing that. We're not, you know, I guess we're trying to reinforce that, you know, it's not about failure. It's about, you know, trying to solve the problem together.
Hmm. That's great.
Well, Richard, I'd bring up too, I think that's a good point. I use the term falling forward, because if you're going to be successful, you're going to have failures. Look at history. It's happened constantly. And that's one thing we try to encourage. At least if you're failing, fail forward so that we can learn from our mistakes and move forward to the next time.
That's a great point.
Absolutely agree as well. Yep.
All right. Well, we have a question from Riley actually wants to know, and this is something I know, Ricardo, you and I have talked about before. I think we talked about this when we did the podcast interview. We were on the line, maybe didn't make the interview itself, but Riley says, I feel like I'm losing the hands-on feeling from when I used to be a designer. How do CDs get back to this primal need to continue designing, but manage schedules, freelancers, copy, budgets, et cetera? Ricardo, do you have any advice for Riley?
Oh, absolutely. It's Riley?
Riley, yes.
Riley is ringing the bell, totally, because this is something that I have come across and will continue to come across. That is a great question. The way that I've handled that is the idea that from the perspective of a creative director is that, Todd, if you recall when we first spoke and we had that podcast, I came up in the business as a graphic designer. I was formally trained as a designer and worked my way up in the ranks to get into this sort of creative director leadership role. But if there's something I can leave with Riley, it's the idea that that's exactly what we do now as a creative director, is that we have to let go of that hands-on approach. And what we're looked on now as a creative director is to be able to communicate back to our art directors or to our colleagues around us those things that we need executed. But what we're specifically looked to is to provide that beacon. We're the strategic arm of that. But it also means that we have to be very versed in, we're still very fluent in the language of design. Mm-hmm. Now, in my particular case, I make it a purpose. I make it a practice that I hire on my team people that are 10 times better than me. And what that does is it allows me to learn from them, but it also allows me to understand that I have to know the lingo, but not necessarily know how to do it. And a perfect case is if we may have something that's going to have to go into an edit, and I have somebody working in Flash, or I have somebody working in Photoshop, I don't need to know the lingo about how many layers he's going to create, how many masks he's going to create, adjustment layers, things like that. But it's this lingo that I'm aware of that I can communicate that to that person. So indirectly, I'm still designing, but I'm taking a step back and celebrating the strength of why I have brought that person on because of their discipline, their specialty. That's one way of looking at it. The other lens that I would say to Riley is that there's absolutely... It is actually perfectly okay to say, okay, I want to step out of this creative director role because I'm finding that it's pulling me to be a bit more administrative than I would like, and I want to get back to that hands-on approach. My suggestion there is make the leap, and I don't mean necessarily back, but make the leap to becoming that design director that is the conduit to sort of the other art directors, and you are that bridge that brings the creative director back to your teams. But the fact that you've been the fact that Riley's moved into this position is because his management and the colleagues around him have elevated him into this role because he presented a talent and a skill set that they were definitely needing. And that's a compliment that he's gone in there. But these are things that only that Riley himself will able to answer to do that. But, you know, there is the reality that in my particular case that, over 60-70% of my time is really a lot more strategic administrative stuff. And the best way that I can illustrate that is my entire office now runs out of a MacBook. Before I had G5s and Wacom tablets and everything, but it's the idea that I've knowingly made that leap. And then I now live vicariously through my other designers that are able to execute the hands-on, if you will. And I'm not sure this is exactly what Riley's asking, but there's ways to do it. And I think one of the things is celebrate the role that you're in, but understand that you're looked on to provide that leadership role, and that you need to be able to pull out the best of all of the members of your team and bring them together. This collaborative discussion and everything that you're talking about, Todd, is that these assassins that you set up, and as well as these conversations, it is so hitting the nail on the head, as Scott would have said earlier, is that because these are things that all of us, that's the reason we're talking today, is because it's triggering something inside of all of us. But very true. Yeah.
Well, Riley just said, yes, perfect answer. Thank you. Just what I needed to hear. So I think you struck a chord.
Either that or you wanted me to shut up, which is okay.
We have
one thing I'll add to this too, Todd, is the I'll use the fact about being a leader, especially creative director. And as I go through my career, you know, I'm looking at, we're keepers of the value, but above all, we're the keepers of the culture. And I keep referring back to Walt Disney when he said, you know, somebody asked, what does he do? Does he draw Mickey Mouse? Is he a voice of Mickey Mouse? And he said, no, I'm the bee that pollinates the flowers. Hmm. And that's how I view our roles as a creative director.
You know, it's interesting because I think there is a tendency to sort of glorify, you know, the people who do the work, but the people who are able to guide the work and the people who are able to actually set the rails and get it where it needs to be. Sometimes there's a little question about value, you know, but that really is the role of a great creative director, is to be able to inspire and keep people within rails, right? Ultimately.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
But, okay.
I think the only other thing I would bring up, and I'm glad Riley voiced it, it's epic to being in that position, is that you miss being that, you know, kind of tightly involved. I'm on a global creative council with Asian and European counterparts, and those guys, you know, not only they're expressing it, you know, over the phone or when we meet, just that, you know, Ricardo said, you know, 60-70% of the time being admin, it's very, very frustrating. But I think you have to, you know, find the spots where you can influence and think and try to solve problems with team members, just so that you keep the fire alive.
Mm. Well, we have a question from Doug, and I'm going to unmute Doug. He has his hand raised. Doug, are you there? Doug Yasuda, are you there? Okay, it could be a false call. All right. Let's see if we have any.
Did he type in his question, Todd?
No, he didn't type in his question. I think he accidentally maybe raised his hand. I'm not really certain. We also have R. Scott has a question. Let's see if he's on the line. R. Scott, are you there? No? Okay. We'll try again. All right, I'll tell you what, let's do this because I want to honor your time. I want to thank you guys so much for being here. Really appreciate you being here. Is there anything, based upon what you've heard tonight, based upon these conversations, based upon the culture within, you know, the organizations that you've experienced over time, is there anything else you would want to add to this conversation? That if you could give people one nugget of wisdom or inspiration about how to lead creative within organizations, and then you would gasp your dying breath and fall over, which is not going to happen, so don't worry. GoToMeeting doesn't have that kind of power. But, you know, what would that advice be? And let's why don't we start with Richard? And sorry to set you up like that. I know I didn't send you that question ahead of time. So something very profound, Richard. Just whatever it is, make sure it's very profound.
I went to some training recently, and, you know, sometimes we kind of roll our eyes at corporate training. But I learned a really interesting thing that I guess I had forgotten to do, and it's called listening. Hmm. And I think because we're always called into a room with a client or with our teams or with, you know, senior leaders within our organization, we always have to have the answer right then and there, or we want to influence thoughts, feelings, or opinions in the room. And I think we just, we forget to do that sometimes. And I think you can learn some startling things when you try to continue to probe a client or a team member that's, you know, experiencing an issue versus always trying to expound on them the wisdom that you have. Mm. I think there's, you know, there's a lot to be said for listening, and we all do it that well.
Mm. Scott, how about you? What would be one bit of advice you would give to a creative leader?
Listen to Todd Henry. He'll be your guide to life. No.
Yeah, and you're going to give out my cell phone number, aren't you?
I'm promoting here, man. No.
Funny.
I would have to say I've been fortunate enough to study, to be around great leaders, and what you have to do is look at a person's character. But above all, I've kind of taken a path of demonstrating how art can enrich everybody's life. And, you know, we have to be who we are, and we have to do what we love. And that's what I really try to make sure that the artists are maintaining in that capacity, that they have the passion for what they're doing, because the minute they lose that passion, it's like a musician, you know, they've kind of lost it and they've got to find themselves again, or an actor. So, you know, be who you are and do what you want.
Good word.
Do what you love.
Ricardo, we'll save the last word for you. What would be your bit of advice?
You know, if I could, first of all, thank you for everyone for joining in on here, and a great insight from both Richard and Scott and yourself, Todd. There, if I could, I'd love to leave sort of two principles and sort of one practical exercise if I could propose that people might be able to actually take away and might consider implementing in their organization. The first of two principles really is something that we've all heard, and I don't think we do enough of, and that is literally surrounding yourself with the best people. And that is the way that I put that in my personal experiences. Hire people that are better than you. And a practice that we do at our organization is, this is really the end goal, is we bring in people constantly, because what it does is it inevitably brings up everybody's game. And more importantly, in the process of hiring, the management people are the last people to see the candidates. It's because the gauntlet of hiring and the interview process is done by the immediate team. It's the teams who interview the person that's coming into the fold with the idea that, what makes you think you're good enough to join our organization? And it's not the sense of arrogance, but it's the sense of confidence that we are the best at what we do. And we have very specific criteria to whom we're going to invite into that fold. And 99.9% of the time, it's someone of equal talent, passion, and drive, if not better talent, passion, and drive. And our game gets stepped up all the time. So it's the idea of surrounding yourself with the best people, better than yourself. People are always progressing and asking and provoking. Taking risks and rewarding them for that risk. The second principle that I think I found, which is a huge trait among leaders, but even prospective leaders and people who are just aware that they're starting to do that, is literally that it's self-awareness. It's the idea that it's okay to show vulnerability to your team, to your colleagues, to your bosses, to your wife, to your friends. It opens you up and it makes you real and it makes you approachable. And that's a huge discipline, to be self-aware. But, you know, a couple of principles there I thought I'd leave. And then one little nugget, Todd, if I could leave with everyone. Something that I've done that's worked amazing for us is it really encapsulates everything that you've set up here with the three ninjas, if you will, as well as the five conversations. And all I did was set up a blank sheet of paper and put three headings on there with five lines under each heading. And I gave them out to my team. This is when I took over a new group within our organization. And the headings simply said, start, stop, and continue. And what it did was it allowed people to speak freely, you know, without having to put their name on it, and gave it back to me. I didn't know who filled it out. But it literally said five things that we should stop doing these things. We should start doing these things, and we should continue doing these things. And it's incredible what you will read from your team and your colleagues when you're able to give this tool, because you start to assemble this and you start to understand that there's a lot of things that people feel, and you're just giving them a forum to be able to speak about it without fear of repercussion, if you will. So it's a very simple sheet, and it literally is start, stop, and continue. And I purposely leave five lines because you don't want people to write off novels and things, but it's amazing when you leave them with five lines, they get into that discipline of really thinking, what are the things that we are doing best, and why did we stop doing those? We should continue to do those. But it's worked well for us, so I'm hoping that that someone else might be able to enjoy it and reap the rewards as we have with it.
That's fantastic. Thank you for sharing that.
Sure.
Great. Well, hey, I want to thank everybody for joining us. Obviously, Ricardo, Richard, and Scott, thanks so much for sharing your thoughts, your insight, your experience. I know this is primetime family time on a Sunday evening, so thanks so much for taking time to build into the community and share your experiences, because this is really, you know, one of the only ways that we're going to overcome this stuff is by breaking down these isolations and sort of the barriers, the artificial barriers that block us from having conversations about these things. But this is so important that we be having these conversations, across organizations, just so we can sort of have some kind of grid, right, to understand what's going on. So thank you for sharing your thoughts, your insight, your wisdom, everything. Really appreciate it. Thanks to everyone for listening in, for being here tonight. It was great to interact with you. I want to reiterate, we will be having we'll be sending you a follow-up email, all of you who are on this call, with a link to a PDF containing the five conversations, as well as some ways you might want to ask them, and an audio download of this that will be a different version than maybe what you heard, because we did get some reported audio glitches tonight. Some people said the audio was fine. Some people were complaining that it was glitchy. So I apologize for that, but we do have a better recording that I'll be sending you, so you can have that as well for your later perusal. Okay. Thanks everybody so much. Really appreciate you being here. And this is probably the first of what we're going to consider our year-long conference at Accidental Creative. We're going to maybe do about one of these events a month, and I'll be sending out more information about that as well. So thanks so much. Have a great night. Remember, folks, it is the age of creativity. Cover bands don't change the world. Don't be a cover band. You've got to find your unique voice if you want to thrive.